And then the Planning Commission, Jim Sykes.
Here.
Matthew Beck.
Here.
George McKee.
Here.
Ted Leonard is running a little late. Dan Mayfield.
Here.
Jesse Sumner.
Here.
Tam Bovee.
Here.
Mary Anderson will not be present. Eileen Patterson.
She's here.
Here.
Thank you.
Patricia Chesbro will not be present. Colleen Vague.
Here.
Chris Elder.
Present.
Stafford. I'm sorry, I don't have my glasses on. Glashen.
Yep, present.
Thank you. Sasan Musanen. Okay. You do have a quorum of both bodies, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Clerk, and let's welcome our two new assembly members, Mr. Sumner and Ms. Bovee. Yes. Welcome to your first official meeting, so we're proud to have you here. So, all right, let's take a look at the agenda. Any changes to the agenda? Anybody want to add or delete? Seeing none, agenda is approved as presented. Mr. Spropoulos, why don't you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance and then get the ball game on. Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor.
Yes, ma'am.
So we can fix the mic issue. We don't know what's happening with this bank, but it's all out. We're going to go get some handheld mics and bring at least two down so when people want to talk, they can.
Mine's working, isn't it?
Yours is working.
Well, forget about them. There would be no questions. No questions, no comments over here on the right. Okay. Let's move on to audience participation. We've reached audience participation. This is the opportunity to speak to the Joint Assembly and the Planning Commission about anything you wish. Do we have a sign-up list? Madam Clerk's checking right now. Mr. Lee, why don't you come on forward? And we haven't seen you for a while.
Mr. Lee, 2020.
2020.
Mm-hmm. He's... I'm. Is this mic working down here, Madam Clerk? Okay. Go ahead and press that button so you get then your name for the record.
My name is Honky Lee, and great to see you, Mayor, and congratulations for your re-election.
Thank you.
And, thank you for having me back. And I just got a new job as a lawyer in Wasilla, so I've been catching up. Been so busy, that's why I was absent. But today I want to talk about the freedom of speech, the First Amendment, right? And congratulations for the new assembly members. So, from what we heard from this lieutenant government resignation is that he said something that offended some people. So that worries me greatly because I thought America was the country of freedom of speech, you know. And so if somebody is forced to quit his job, if somebody loses his job just because he or she said something, because we should never be afraid to make some jokes, or sometimes we make verbal mistakes. We are human beings. And if somebody is losing a job just because some words that this person said, that I don't think that's America. That's more like North Korea, okay, or Cuba or some communist or dictatorial nation. So it really worries me. So there was a kind of prelude, and I love this Masu Baro meeting and City of Wasilla meeting because you give us, you know, common people, freedom of speech. This is great. So you ladies and gentlemen are preserving the Constitution, because if we do not exercise constitutional rights, Constitution dies. So it's so important. I'm very grateful for the borough, City of Wasilla, you know, giving us this opportunity to exercise the constitutional right of freedom of speech. So I have like 46 seconds left. So if I may, exercise some freedom of speech right, okay? I'm going to tell you something that will not be very popular, okay? So I oppose gay marriage. I oppose transgender bathroom. I oppose legalization of marijuana. I oppose tattoos and I oppose piercings. And I oppose plastic surgeries. In my opinion, I also oppose obesity, okay? So in my belief, those are the ones that's ruining America. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Did we have more in the sign-up list, Madam Clerk? Okay, anybody else in the audience wish to speak to the joint group? Seeing nobody, we'll close audience participation at this time. We'll go straight to our joint items of business, but I just wanted to let the Planning Commission know that the Assembly referred Title 28-6, which was Ordinance 18093, to the Planning Commission at the last meeting for 90 days, but don't feel like if you need more time, that's a kind of a rewrite of all our logging things and issues that were current, so just want to let you know that. So now let's go to the Planning Board. Mr. Wagner or Ms. Probasco, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the Planning Commission and Assembly. I'm Eileen Probasco, the Planning Director. We do have several items on the list tonight. I think the first five of them are going to go relatively quickly, but the one that I'm going to allow the most time for is the last item, flood management discussion. Alex Strawn will be doing a presentation. He was recently able to attend some training and has some really interesting stuff to share with you folks. So it's always our goal to have you out of here by 8 o'clock. If we can get out of here sooner than that, that's a plus, but I know there's a ball game going on and you all have things to do. So thanks for letting us update you with some of our great projects.
Thank you. So we got Transportation Advisory Board update, Mr. Coleman. Plattimore, excuse me. I thought we were just finished. I wasn't listening. I was reading Ms. Planning Board resolution, so excuse me.
Good evening, Mayor Halter, Assembly and Planning Commission members, Mr. Moosey and staff. Thank you for this opportunity to present to you or to update you on the Planning Board and the Planning Division. You will find in your packet that we included Planning Board Resolution 2018-24. This resolution stemmed from the Planning Board's challenge of balancing public need and safety from the impact of increased population density and traffic generated, excuse me, by new developments, with what the Planning Board can reasonably require petitioners and developers to upgrade. The Planning Board's concerns are interconnectivity, public safety, emergency services, the International Fire Code, and infrastructure developments. You will also find in your packet a copy of the Title 43 parking lot items. This is a memo from March of 2017. This parking lot, also known in our department as the whiteboard, is a list of changes that were suggested by Matsu Borough staff, petitioners, engineers, surveyors, Assembly Planning Board, and Planning Commission members, as well as the general public. The list you see was presented to the Assembly, who in turn directed the Planning Board to address these concerns. After several months and multiple work sessions involving staff, developers, and the general public, the Planning Board moved forward with their recommended changes, and these changes were then presented to both the Planning Commission the Planning Commission for review and the Assembly for adoption. It has been approximately 1 year since those changes were adopted. During this span, planning staff has continued to receive and compile additional items and concerns. The Planning Board has thus requested that the planning staff now bring these changes forward. We're in the process of putting that together, and we will present them to the Assembly when they're ready. Last year, the Assembly requested that the planning staff initiate the much needed update to the 1991 Subdivision Construction Manual. The update began just prior to the cyber incident and has been on hold as the borough has recovered. Staff is now ready to resume this process, and we have meetings scheduled for October 30th and November 13th. I'd like now to just give you a brief overview on what platting has accomplished in the past year. We recorded 110 plats, created 449 new lots from 82 parcels. Also, during a time of our reduced services due to the cyber attack, platting staff rose to the challenge and accepted 34 cases, recorded 24 plats, held 60 pre-application conferences, changed 7 road names, and filed 5 replats. Then, just because we could, the fire safe room, where we keep the original historical documents, was emptied, cleaned, organized, and inventoried. This massive effort was completed just last week and should be good for another 50 years, or at least that's the story I'm sticking with. If you have any questions.
Any questions? I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now with Mr. Coleman. Transportation Advisory Board update.
Good evening, Mayor Halter, Chair Vague, members of the Assembly and Commission. Just a quick overview of the work plan for TAB, some of the major items that they'll be weighing in on. First, we have bond fund sources, so trying to figure out where the 50% match is going to come from. So that'll be a major effort in the near future. The official streets and highways plan, that's another document that's out of date, kind of piggybacking on some of the platting issues and enhancing connectivity. What this plan does is it creates an official map which outlines some of the necessary roads and future connections to help avoid costly retrofits 10, 20, 30 years into the future. The weigh-in on the UMED district, there's a major transportation component for that to function effectively. And then finally, the long-range transportation plan update. Thank you.
Thank you. Historic Preservation Board update. Mr. Eichheit, welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, everyone. I'm Ted Eichheit, a planner with the borough. I'd like to give an update on our Historic Preservation Commission. I just finished my first year, and I think we had some nice accomplishments. First of all, the goal of the HPC, if I can use our acronym, is to promote our cultural and historic heritage here in the Mat-Su Borough. In 2017, we only had one meeting due to some quorum issues. So I'm pleased that so far this year we've had 4 meetings. Another 2 were canceled. One was because of a quorum issue, but I'm pleased with having 4 meetings. And we spread those out around the borough. One was here at the borough building. One was just in Willow last week, Kinnick Museum, places like that. Our accomplishments this year include swearing in 3 new members, which has helped a bit with our quorum issues, making comments on historic preservation efforts in the borough, discussing revisions to the borough code guiding the HPC, that conversation is continuing, and discussing the need for a long-term historic preservation plan, something I'm very passionate about to guide future efforts. Finally, I have benefited myself from training this last year. Specifically, in May, I had a chance to do a 3-day workshop with National Park Service on historic preservation. And in July, I went to Des Moines, Iowa to learn about preservation issues. And I'm also pleased that the first workshop was free, and the second one I got a grant to attend, so no taxpayer money directly for that training. But I do appreciate that opportunity. I believe it's benefited me. We do continue to struggle on our board with vacant positions. It's a 9-member board. We only have 5 members at present, which is our quorum requirement. And I do encourage anyone that has an interest in history, especially anyone with professional credentials in things like architecture, history, archaeology, to apply for the commission because we need the expertise of people in the community. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Any questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank
you. Now we're at the borough-wide comprehensive plan update, and Ms. Barrasco's back.
I didn't want to copy these for all you guys, so I just brought one copy.
You're lucky Eugene's not here.
I know. I know. That's good. That's good. I'm glad he is. So, borough-wide comprehensive plan update. We are going to undertake this project in the very near future. And I'm going to do a quick little... I forgot my glasses. Well, good thing I printed this big. I'm going to start with a little history refresher. Alaska became a state, of course, in 1959. And in 1964, the state of Alaska created 8 municipalities. They were Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, Kodiak, Kenai, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Matsu Borough, of course, became a second-class borough. I couldn't tell you what these other ones were classified as. Oh, gosh, bless her heart. Oh, man, don't pay her enough. So on your little sheet, as a second-class borough, there are certain things that are required by a second-class borough, and they are, as the state says here, you're a borough, manage this land to serve the public health, safety, and welfare, take care of our roads, build us some good schools, don't mess up our water quality, and provide recreational opportunities, et cetera. So there's a certain number of things we have to do. You'll see that on the blue on the left side. You have to provide education, which is why we have our school district. We have to do planning and land use, and we use property taxation to fund those items. And then on the right side, you'll see there's a variety of different powers that we can adopt, and which we already have, of course. There's a list there that lists many of them, but there are certainly more that we can adopt as a second-class borough.
Is that mandatory nudity under can do?
What's nudity?
To regulate adult businesses and so forth. Adult businesses. And we do have an adult business chapter within our zoning code that is woefully out of date, and we're working on revising that. That was good, right? Yeah, okay. So we were formed in 1964, and our first borough comprehensive plan was adopted in 1970, and here's what it looks like. Pretty old. There's the background survey and analysis. They involved the public and other agencies and so forth. They did a lot of public outreach and came up with this plan. And it was pretty cool to sit back and go through this. It consists of, at that point, the regions consisted of Palmer, Wasilla, Matanuska, which is kind of now the core area. This refers to Mackenzie Point. And there, it also refers to Wasilla, Big Lake, Willow, Nancy Lake, Talkeetna, and Sutton. So those were the communities at that time that were focused on in this original book. It's really cool to see, as you look through some of the goals in their plans, one of their main goals, Nancy Lake State Recreation Area. Of course, the state has taken on that, and they have a great park out there. Hatchapas Ski Area was high on the list of goals in that area. South Denali development, some kind of recreational and tourism opportunities on the south side of the mountain. The creation of Port Mackenzie. The Kinnickarm Crossing is mentioned in there quite a bit. And a Big Lake recreational area. And I found it interesting when I was reading that at the time the plan was being crafted, contamination from septics was a big issue at that time. So. Other issues that they addressed throughout the plan were transportation, school locations, public facilities, solid waste, such as where is the dump going, tourism, recreation, air and water quality, aviation, resource development, cultural resources and history, and of course separating residential from commercial and industrial development land uses, making sure that there wasn't there was some sort of reasoning and separation of these conflicting uses. So that was in 1970, and in 1984, did I just get louder there? Yeah, thank you. In 1984, an attempt was made to update the plan, and that failed in 1984, but the assembly adopted a resolution establishing a policy that the borough would do planning on a community by community basis. And during that period of time was when chapter 2.76 community councils was adopted, which kind of set the framework for these communities establishing their own residential organization type thing to make their own decisions. And aside from the cities of Palmer, Wasilla, and Houston, Chicoloon Community Council was the first one to adopt their own comprehensive plan. and then others followed. And as they were adopted, they became chapters of the existing plan. So that's kind of how the structure works. So fast forward to today, we were able to do an update, finally, of the 1970 Comprehensive Plan. And I made you all a copy of that because it's not really terribly big. So I encourage you to just take this and look at it. It's got a lot of really good information in it. And it shows you the types of things that we'll be looking at and talking about when we contemplate an update to that plan. Of course, a lot has changed since 2005, so we'll be doing extensive public outreach and surveys and gathering data, demographics, et cetera, doing a lot of research and coming forward with an updated overall comprehensive plan. So as a result of establishing the community councils and having a community-by-community planning effort, with 24 community councils, 15 of them have their own comprehensive plans, and our task for making sure those are up to date is just becoming more and more challenging. So as part of this comprehensive plan update, we're going to be looking at ways that we can do things better in our planning department to be more efficient in reaching the communities and planning maybe, you know, on a regional basis as opposed to each individual community. But that's certainly something that'll shake out in the whole process. But it's going to be a really big effort, and I want you to know that it's on the horizon. So you'll be aware when you start getting questions about it, you'll know what we're working on. Do you have any questions about that? Please take home the plan and glance through it. It's really a good one. Okay.
Questions? Anybody? Comments? Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to go on to the next item on the agenda then, which is...
On that, I do have a...
Sure.
That in 2005 mm-hmm. update, I'm just trying to find a page again. There's an analysis of the Mattsu Borough population, page 3, 2025, is that pretty accurate? 154,800 coming up from 2015, 92.7.
I couldn't speak to that. I haven't researched those numbers.
Could you guys take a look at that and
oh, absolutely.
And get us an update?
Oh, yeah, you bet. Actually,
because that's a 2025 is not very far away, you know.
Right, and that was a projection at that time. It might be revised by this point, but I don't know. But certainly during the census, we'll have a lot better information on that as well. But we can get some projection figures.
We're at 105 now, correct? 1,000?
Let me see.
What, pardon? 107, 107,000 now. So by 2025, we jumped to 154,000. That'd be
a lot.
That'd be a lot. Thank you.
It's a technical term. I made it up. Okay, the next thing I'm going to talk about really briefly is another big project that we have coming up. And I like to give you guys a heads up if you're going to be getting phone calls about what are we doing and what are we working on and why are they asking me this information. So we are nearing the census. And as we are looking at our census figures, and trying to prepare for that, the Census Bureau has several different programs that they do ahead of time to kind of make sure that when the census starts, it's we're well prepared for it. We've given them updated information on boundaries, housing, and things like that. So we are going to be visiting the boundaries of the community councils within the core area because that item is of particular concern for us for a couple of different reasons. So if you look at this little fact sheet, there's a project scope and purpose. One of the things, of course, is to make sure we give good information to the census so they can give us good numbers. But the first one is that we've identified areas within the core area that are not within a community council boundary. So it's challenging to try and reach some of those folks in an area outside of a community council when things are going on in their area. So we're trying to resolve two issues. First of all, being able to notify and include the public better on information, things that might affect them in their area. And second, prepare for the census. So that's the reason we're looking at this right now. Further down in the facts, it just talks about the community councils that are in that area, when it was established, And the problem that has to do with the numbers is, if you look at that little map on the back, you kind of have a majority of the core area, but if you see those little hash marks that go like that, those are the neighborhoods and the areas within the core area that aren't included in a community council, and therefore the census figures for our core area, we're not able to get really accurate figures. So this will hopefully resolve that issue. So it'll improve the borough in a couple of ways. First, better notification on certain items in that area, and second, better census figures, which will then open the door for additional federal transportation funds. And so I put our schedule on there, our tentative schedule, and contact information is Chris Cole, one of our planners. He's here tonight if any questions pop up. But on the back, if you see the highlighted yellow areas, we have Farm Loop, Gateway, North and South Lakes, and Tenina that are community councils in there. But if you look at that balance number, there are a lot of people that are in an area that's not represented by a census designated place or community council. So we're trying to resolve that and reduce that number and more accurately reflect the population. So just an update on our upcoming project that you might be getting some phone calls and inquiries about, so you can direct them to us and you'll kind of know what we have on our plate. Any questions about that?
Any questions, comments? Doesn't look like it.
I do.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Thank you, through the Mayor. Are all of these community councils active and current?
They are not.
So do you have a list of the ones that are not active, and are they not active by choice or because we haven't kept up with their activity?
I don't know off the top of my head all of them that are active or inactive. The clerk's office keeps a record of the requirements for being designated as active or inactive. I know within the core area there are three of the five are active, and the other two are inactive. The three that are active are Gateway, Farm Loop Community, and North Lakes Community Council. So maybe by adjusting these boundaries, we'll be able to identify some neighborhoods that are willing to kind of step up and reactivate those councils again and get some interest going. So.
I have a question.
Assemblymember Mayfield.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd actually like to go back to the borough-wide comprehensive plan update for just a moment. So if we're considering revisiting the borough-wide comprehensive plan, what happens with the community comprehensive plans that we have out there? And would we undergo an effort to update a community's comprehensive plan, or would we simply stick with the borough comprehensive plan?
When we update the overall comp plan, it's not going to supersede any of the community plans at all. Generally, our policy has been we update the community plans as the communities come forward and ask us. We don't necessarily go and say, okay, it's time to do this. We have to. So they'll remain in place. But as a result of our borough-wide effort, we're definitely going to try and set out some goals to be more efficient in addressing some of those community plans, so we don't put ourselves in a position where we can't achieve what we're supposed to do. But, you know, the Big Lake comp plan was, what, 10 years ago or so? Yeah. It's probably time for them, but comparatively, some of them are older than that. Kinnick Fairview, I think, is 97, and yeah, so.
And I had known there was some talk of updating the no plan particularly, but I know there was some discussion about updating the comprehensive plan for Big Lake. So would that be something that we would still move forward with if the community decided that that was something that they needed?
I would certainly put it as a priority. Definitely the communities that are really active and want to make sure they're actively involved in the decisions that go on there, Those are the ones that get funding for their projects and so forth. So we're not gonna deny that. But hopefully, as we go through this process, it'll help us identify a more efficient way to do it. Is from, you know, a variety of things we're contemplating, from a more standardized format rather than, you know, 12 different comp plans in 12 different formats. We might come up with a standardized one so that we can, you know, more easily update the general information. And that's just one of the things we've discussed. But yeah, certainly if there's community interest, those are the folks we love to work with.
Senator Sykes.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through the mayor, Director Probasco, I believe that all of the community councils that have a comp plan, that's part of our code. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so don't we have a legal requirement, a state legal requirement, to periodically update the overall plan?
Yes. I don't know that it has a specific number. It's a recommendation. It's not a hard and fast, you have to do it every, you know, 5 years or something. They just say it should be revisited and updated every 5 to 10 years or whatever the number is.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Anyone else? Questions? Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So in redrawing the boundaries, are you considering just expanding the existing community council areas or perhaps starting new ones? Just looking at this area around the city of Palmer, seems kind of like a contiguous area that maybe has some different values than, say, Gateway.
And that's a good point. We have met with some of those community councils. We've talked about different, in certain areas, what would make sense as far as drawing a different line, you know, north or east of, for example, Palmer Fishhook or Wasilla Fishhook or something. So we've discussed a couple different things. We haven't finalized it. It doesn't seem unreasonable to me that considering the south area of Palmer, where there is a lot of area that's not in the community council, that might be ripe for starting a new one. So we're working with lines on the map, but we don't have anything finalized yet to ready to bring forward. But certainly we're open to figuring that all out.
Anything else in this?
Thank you.
Mr. Spropoulos.
Mr. Mayor, as per your direction, this is the top of the sixth, Red Sox 5, Dodgers 3.
You're fired. You're fired. You can't come up with a better report than that. Mr. Strawn, you've got the flood management discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the Assembly, and members of the Planning Commission. I appreciate you taking the time every year or twice a year to have this meeting. It's always a good time for planning to display what they've got going on and what we can look forward to. My discussion today is on floodplain management, and we have some unique challenges here. But before we really dive into that, I really want to go over a history of how we got here, not only on a local level, but on a federal level. So I'm going to bring us all the way back to the 1800s and give you really a brief history. There's a lot of things that happened in between the events I'm about to discuss, but I'm kind of hitting some of the high points here. So it really all started with the Mississippi River. That's the first time that the federal government got involved in floodplain management. And it really was a major effort to build levees. And there's a lot of turf wars. Ultimately, it was divided into levee districts. There was levee wars where certain communities had more money, where they'd build the biggest levee and it would flood the people downstream, and then they'd, you know, the levees kept getting bigger and bigger, and those who built the biggest levees won. And ultimately, what it did is constricted the river and lead to more flooding and failure of some of these levees. But in the 1860s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers basically had all we do is we build levees and dams, and that was their solution to managing floods. 1913 was the Ohio River Valley Flood. Very catastrophic, 650 people or so dead, a quarter of a million people left homeless as a result of it. And you'll see a recurring theme that as disasters occur, then laws get adopted, right? They're written in blood. And that's kind of the way we've acted when it comes to this throughout history. Congress in 1917 formally recognized that it's one of their responsibilities to sort of do something about flooding and come up with some sort of program to address it. Because really, at this point, entire communities would be so devastated that they might just, you know, shut down and not recover, or at least never be the same as they were prior. And there was loss of life and very difficult for a lot of these communities. 1927, the Great Mississippi River Flood, again, very devastating, really punched a lot of holes in this approach that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had of just building levees, and really raised the notion that there's probably a better way. And as shortly after that, all private insurance companies said, we're not going to cover flooding. We're just not doing it. We don't have any of the we don't know where the flood risk is. There haven't been a lot of studies, so we don't really know how to insure people at what level and things like that. So they just completely pulled out. So we had an entire nation not covered by flood insurance until 1936, when the Congress sort of, well, no, we're not there yet. They adopted the Flood Control Act, which it was a two-pronged approach. They had the Department of Agriculture, which was responsible for creating like these huge retention basins to kind of collect rainwater and try to prevent flooding, and then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which went forward with building their dams and their levees. 1950, Disaster Relief Act, which is a big one that's still in place. This allowed municipalities such as ourselves to declare disasters and request federal funding in times of disaster. That was a pretty big deal right there. And shortly after was a giant flood where 17 people died and 500,000 people were left homeless. So I'm sure because they just adopted that policy, they paid a lot of money for that. And Truman at the time, this is a pretty good quote for him. The lack of a national system of flood disaster insurance is now a major gap in the means by which a man can make a home, his farm, or his business secure against events beyond his control. Pretty powerful quote right there. In 1956, the Federal Flood Insurance Act was adopted, and this it covered any dwelling that was subject to flooding could be covered up to $10,000 regardless of where it was. They could be 50 miles from a river or 50 feet from a river, it didn't matter. And this, in one form or another, is actually still in place right now. Communities that don't have adopted maps and things like that, this is still something that can be utilized. In 1956, American Insurance Association did a study which determined that private flood insurance is still just a non-feasible thing. We just don't have the data out there to have a viable insurance of structures for flooding. And then in 1957, shortly after that, Congress withdrew funding from the insurance, the Federal Insurance Agency, which was responsible for implementing that because of lack of data. And so at that time, really, there was a lot of ideas about how the federal government could actually tackle this. And you'll see where we get. 1967, Fairbanks had a major flood. And obviously, that's, you can see downtown Fairbanks there is under quite a bit of water. This was particularly bad in the sense that they had an early warning system that was tied to a gauge, but the gauge was placed in a spot that they didn't know that the flood was going to happen. So really, people were made aware of the flood when it was at their door. There were 700 people displaced and 4 people killed in that one. And this was, so the next year, interestingly, Fairbanks is the first. There's two actually communities that applied on the same day, but Fairbanks is tied with being the first community to enter the National Flood Insurance Program. And this was kind of that flood kind of put the nail in the coffin and sort of forced Congress to adopt something, and they ended up adopting the National Flood Insurance Program, which created the National Flood Insurance Act, which created the National Flood Insurance Program and the Flood Insurance Administration. And essentially what this is, it's kind of a partnership between communities and the federal government, right? And we are one of 22,000 or so communities that are part of the National Flood Insurance Program. It provides subsidized flood insurance to anybody who wants to get it. As part of the deal, they require that any federally backed loan, if it's for a home in a flood zone, then they have to get flood insurance. It's mandatory. Part of that, along with that, goes mapping and studies to determine what the flood risk is in different areas. And so that's our flood zones that we've adopted. And then participating communities must voluntarily adopt and enforce minimum standards. So that's, for us, that's MSB 17.29. And I'm gonna skip forward a little bit to 1985, which is when we entered the National Flood Insurance Program and we adopted our flood code. It doesn't prevent people from developing in flood zones. Congress at the time recognized that people like to develop along rivers and lakes. It's some of the most valuable property in the entire nation. And so they didn't prevent that, but what they did is they said, you have to develop to these standards, you have to raise up your building so that if a flood comes in, it's going to be reasonably safe from flooding and to really minimize the insurance that they have to pay out also, right? So they do, as part of this, every 5 years, they audit the borough or all the participating communities. And they come and they ensure that our regulations are still meeting the minimum standards of the Code of Federal Regulations. They look at old newspaper articles that happened within that time frame. They come into the borough and they pull files off of our shelf to rifle through them. We drive them around into all the different flood zones in the borough, and it's a pretty in-depth review process to ensure that we are enforcing the minimum standards that we have in our code. So while most of our discretion or our enforcement is discretionary, in this case, we really do need to enforce our flood code 100%. So jumping back just a little bit, just to keep the chronology going here, 1971 Butte flood. This is one that played a major role. This was sort of a catalyst for us actually changing our maps, and I'll get into that in a little bit on why this played a role in that. But this was isolated to the Sutton and the Butte. And what it was, a lot of people think it was Lake George breaking out, but that's not the case. It was actually Granite Creek up in Sutton. There was a earthen dam that was a naturally existing dam that held a perched lake up in the mountains that during a heavy rainfall, it overtopped and bust out that earthen dam, rushed into basically Sutton and damaged some of our infrastructure there, flowed down the Matanuska and flooded the Butte. And that's what caused the 1971 Butte flood.
The old Glen there?
That is the old Glen, yep. Right. Thank you, Lonnie. I think it really hit McKechnie Loop, actually. Surely. So 1986 was a major borough-wide flood. It's right there with our 2012 flood as far as the magnitude, the amount of water that was going through our systems. It was devastating for borough infrastructure and many homes. I didn't have a lot of time to pull too many pictures, but just to give you an idea of some of the infrastructure and homes that were impacted, it's said to cost about $20 million in damage to infrastructure and private homes. So, 1995, Knick River flood, that's the old Glen right there, deep Butte on the Knick River. And that highway right there has since been raised, right? Critical infrastructure and highways that are, funded by federal dollars and things like that really need to be built to the 500-year flood zone, and that's the standard for that. And unfortunately, this one was not. I'm just going to run through some pictures really fast. 2006 was a major flood event. At this point, we were pretty sophisticated, had an emergency operations center. I'm just pulling some highlights here. Bottom left is downtown Talkeetna. Bottom right, I think that guy probably got a flood permit because he's raised up above the waters and is high and dry, and he is either sheltering in place or got out of there. It looks like he might have sheltered in place because his truck is still there. But certainly the upper right corner, that guy should have gotten a permit. we lost a lot of infrastructure on this one, a lot of roads, and this is a fraction. I have so many pictures from this event that are really striking, and there was a ton of damage, and thankfully in 1950 the Congress adopted the Disaster Relief Act, right? Because we were compensated for some of these projects for rebuilding them. Fortunately, our Talkeetna sewer and water was unaffected. That was raised just above the 100-year floodplain. And if you look at Talkeetna, which is almost entirely within a flood zone, there is a donut hole where that sewer septic system is, or the treatment system there. Some more critical infrastructure that was pretty well damaged in the 2006 flood. Railroad. And then in 2012, we had obviously a major event that affected much of the borough, and I'm just going to breeze through a few pictures of that. You know, this is a dangerous situation. If there's people in that house, that's potentially dangerous. This is kind of a striking map of all the different road closures that were throughout the borough, and this truly was a borough-wide event, and it was a lot of these places are one way in, one way out, so there's definitely a rescue component to this, you know, getting people to where they can get to safety. And then pollution is a major part of flood events. Whenever civilization is flooded, there's pollution that goes with that. You always see oil sheen in the water during flood events, and you see trash floating down and all sorts of stuff that goes in the water. And of course, this is a certain type of pollution that can occur. Kind of a cool picture that ADN took right there. Some more infrastructure that was damaged. I'm sure that rail bridge wasn't cheap to replace. Talkeetna. More Talkeetna. And then some rather dangerous and scary looking pictures. Hopefully there's nobody in those houses. And everybody remembers this one. It fell in the river before it got hauled out, but the river almost took this one. an interesting thing is that many people say, oh, well, I didn't get wet in 2012 when we had the big flood. Well, if you look at Willow Creek, for instance, it was not considered a 100-year flood, right? It was less than a 100-year flood. So in that event, it'll actually get higher than it was, even though there's a lot of houses that flooded in that event. When they say this 100-year flood, it's actually on a river-by-river basis. And we have that information. If people want to know what type of event was this, we can give them that information. Okay, so 2011 was a big year for us because we were able to get LIDAR data. And it stands for light detection and ranging. It's like radar, but with laser beams, right? And as a simplified version, I'm sure Glash staff would concur. But basically, this was a joint effort. I believe it was the U.S. Geological Survey who pitched in some money, and there was the coastal management plan money that came in, so from the state, and then we facilitated the development. We're essentially the project managers for making this happen, and we got high resolution imagery or elevation data throughout the borough. And we were very specific when we had it done that it had to meet the minimum standards for FEMA to update their maps. Because in 1985, when they adopted our flood maps, at best we had 5-foot contours. Right, they're basing their data on 5-foot contours, and 5 feet's like this tall. And if you think about a flood event, that makes a big difference. If something is right here, that's considered 5 feet down, right? And in some many cases, we had worse than 5 foot contours, and we suspected that all of our maps were grossly incorrect, because when we were actually forcing the people to get permits and regulating at this using these maps, a lot of times it just didn't make sense on the ground. We had people who were up high on cliffs that were in the flood zone that couldn't possibly be flooded, at least by the river that was next to them. This was interesting. It was kind of controversial, and there are some people that believe that Google Earth was enough, but really this is so much more than Google Earth, and the benefits of it have been profound. Okay, so back to the 1971 flood. Essentially, we had, our planning department had $15,000 that was freed up from some other project or something, and we were looking a way to leverage that money to do a cool project. And what we really wanted to do was get this flood zone fixed out in the Butte, because it was based on this one-time event that couldn't possibly happen again, and we knew that this particular event couldn't happen again. So we tried to leverage that money. Ultimately, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said, you know what, you keep your $15,000. We have $250,000 that we can use to study the Butte and remap that flood zone. And the goal was to redo that area of the borough, at least. And they did that, and here's the result. If the blue there is the results of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the red is the old 1985 study that was done. And if you zoom in to that area right there, we'll zoom into that. All those blue dots are houses, at least of 2011, or as of 2011. So all of those houses in that red zone right there will be coming out of the flood zone when the new maps are adopted. That means they will not have to pay insurance. They can if they want at a greatly reduced rate. They won't have to get permits. And so just in the Butte area, that's gonna be substantially helpful to all those people out there and long overdue. So we had this project going, and we started in on this process with FEMA to get that remapped. And before I move on here, so the stats are we're going from 879 homes in the flood zone just in the Butte to 81, and that's 2011 numbers, and that's any structure over 480 square feet. So. And as a stopgap here, we started issuing letters of map amendment. And what that is, it's a FEMA letter that essentially says you are out of the flood zone, basically. And we, as a service, because we knew this was mapped so incorrectly, we started processing these for people and sending them off to FEMA and using the LIDAR data to get them approved. We were, as far as I know, the first municipality out there we had to break ground and work with FEMA, but we were able to get LOMAs approved without having to get a survey. We used LIDAR data. We did that, and then this is back when Begich was when he was a senator, and we got the top brass of FEMA into this assembly chambers and said, hey, look, we have a problem, because it became very obvious when we got the LIDAR data that our flood zones did not match the contours at all. And it was just glaringly obvious. And it was like, hey, look, we're expected to regulate to this. We need some good maps. And they came through. They gave us the largest remapping project in the entire nation. And the program they do it through is called the RISC MAP process. MAP is an acronym standing for Mapping Assessments and Planning. And we are currently on the tail end of that and expect to get new maps either this spring or this summer, hopefully this spring. Here's the list of water bodies that are being updated. It's 316 riverine miles that are being remapped. And I pulled this, I've showed this to some of the assembly members have seen this before, but I kind of randomly picked an area of the borough just to demonstrate the difference here. This is the old flood zone. You can see it really doesn't match the contours. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And those pink rectangles are actually structures that are in the flood zone. Here's what the new flood zone will look like. It follows the lowlands and the contours and looks like what water would look like if that area was inundated with flooding. So because of the LIDAR data, it's very, very accurate. The only places where it's not accurate is where we've had erosion. But overall, we're very, very satisfied with the results of this. We also have the 500-year data for a 500-year event, and which is, I think, a useful tool if we're going to build critical infrastructure such as fire stations and things like schools. We don't want to build those in the 500-year floodplain. And then we have the 2,000-year event, which haven't quite found a use for that, but I know if you're not in that, you're high and dry for sure. And this is...
Where is that mapping at, that location?
This is out... This is definitely Little Susitna. I'm not sure. Yeah. So some preliminary stats, and take these with extreme caution because there's a lot of, this is 2011 data. It was a snapshot in time. It's only structures that are over 480 square feet. So I'm not sure if they're homes or if they're a garage or whatever. My preliminary analysis was that we have about 1,100 homes that were in the flood zone and coming out. Okay, so they're going to be happy. 45 people that are in a regulatory floodway that are coming out. So floodways are areas where we've identified through the mapping process that they're, that area of highest danger. And if you're to fill the entire flood zone with 1 foot of water or 1 foot of soil, it would be the area that would be inundated by flooding. So it's kind of, it's a engineering exercise, but. So those people are coming out, which is great news. There's about 120 or so homes that are not in the flood zone that are coming in. Okay, so they're going to be the unhappy ones. And I would say that the FEMA maps have been changed a little bit since these stats have come out. So these are general. And 9 homes that were out of the flood zone and now are going to be in a floodway. So those people are going to require some extra special outreach because if they are substantially damaged or if they substantially improve their home, they're going to have to come into compliance with our regulations, which does require some engineering. It's very expensive. So, and then about 656 or so homes that are going to be, they're in the flood zone and are going to stay in the flood zone. Project schedule, it's a long one, but the bottom line is we're expecting the letter of final determination probably in December. And as soon as we get that, we can go forward with an ordinance to adopt the maps. And that's going to be our intent, to just roll with that as fast as we possibly can. Okay, so challenges that we face here. And we have some interesting ones that popped up when we got the LIDAR that came to our attention. And some ones that we just need to work through and figure out how to prevent them from happening in the future. So. This is one right here. Those of you who know your geology, that is called an alluvial fan, right? And so it's characterized by a very steep, very narrow canyon that kind of dumps out into a flat area. And over geologic time, the river kind of goes back and forth, and creates this fan. And if you turn on the imagery in our parcel data, you'll see that we have a subdivision right on that thing. These fans are notorious for very rapid, unpredictable flooding. I have family that lives on this fan. It's a great place to live. It's got beautiful views and everything like that. But I know we had a platting board update, and we have at least one platting member in here. I think that going forward, we really should consider, because right now this could still happen under our current subdivision regulations. This could still just go in, and so we might want to consider things like this when we go through the subdivision process. There's borough roads in there, here's some LIDAR data, and you can see there's a nice river bottom there. That's actually the Susitna River. And just as a kind of a fun exercise, if you were to plan out a city, where would you put it? I would think you'd want to put it up on the high ground right there, but the fact is that we put a city right there, and we put a major subdivision right there that's completely built out, right in the middle of that river bottom, and that's Talkeetna, and just to the west of that is Trapper Creek. Talkeetna is literally built on the bottom of a riverbed, and it's where the Kashwitna, the Talkeetna, and the Big Sioux all meet together right there, and it's definitely taken up that entire river bottom at one point or another in time. In fact, it's gone through some changes in recent history, and I'll show you that. There's the overlay with our parcel data. So if you look at 2004, and hopefully you can see those arrows, 2004, the majority of that water was on the west side of the river and kind of heading away from Talkeetna. And then if you look at the 2017 imagery, it's at a kind of a crash course right into Talkeetna. And that's what's causing the erosion that's occurring right now. We do have a revetment that's built right there, but if you haven't been to Talkeetna, if you get a chance to go to Talkeetna, go check this river out. It is amazingly powerful. It makes the Matanuska look like a tiny little stream. It's kind of a scary situation. So if you look at 2004 versus 2017, you can see the difference there. And even 2011, it was nice and rounded out like that. And if you you kind of flip back, that's the exact same extent there. You can see that change. And then that red line there, I just had a code compliance officer go out and take GPS points of where the river is now. So since March of 2017, when this imagery was taken, it's eaten that much river. So it is really actively eating away at that. The good news is that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers they have identified this as an issue, right? They just, like literally yesterday, we got the email, like as I'm putting this PowerPoint presentation together, that Congress authorized them to move forward with a solution, so they're going to evaluate it. Now, we're talking years in the making before any sort of solution can come forward, but this is a major step. They're moving forward. So hopefully Mother Nature cooperates with us enough to buy us a little bit of time. This is just an entire subdivision in the bottom of a riverbed. It's in a regulatory floodway. It was built before we had flood zones. It was built before we had good data to show that it's actually in the bottom of a riverbed. This is Willow Creek Estates. They flooded heavily both in 2006 and 2012. So just another one of the challenges that we have here. And I think, currently with our subdivision regulations, we allow subdivisions in the flood zone. We allow roads to be built in the flood zone. We allow 1-acre parcels in the flood zone. All we have to really do is identify it on the plat. That's the rule. This slide got cut off a little bit, so here's another challenge we have right now. We have stream gauges, and stream gauges are a really vital tool, not only for, a big one obviously is it's available online. It gives you alerts if you have go into flood stage or something like that. We as the borough, when rivers go into flood stage, we're on Facebook, we're letting people know that, hey, we're putting out press releases and things like that. Hey, we're at action stage and be prepared because there's rain in the forecast, things like that. It's an early warning system, but it also is used for modeling flood zones. When you have a river gauge on a stream that you're trying to model, then it really helps with the modeling to make it more accurate. And there are two, we'll go to the next one here. The two that were in jeopardy right now are Montana Creek and Kashwitna River. And we just got, those have been funded for the past few years through Fish and Wildlife Service. We recently, like literally just like 3 days ago, got an email saying, hey, the funding has lapsed on that, and unless the borough wants to fund these two, they're just gonna go away. We're gonna decommission them. It's the USGS that actually operates and maintains those. And they said it costs $12,000 annually to keep those running. So that's a decision that we can make here in the next budget cycle if we want to. Okay, and I'm wrapping up here, okay? So floodplains are really, if they're natural still and undeveloped, they help to attenuate water from floods. Floods actually add fertility to the soil. It makes for great farmland. They serve as critical habitat for both terrestrial and aquatic organisms. They have the potential to have a public use, like as a park or trails or places to go fishing or whatever it may be. When they get developed, it decreases the flood carrying capacity because there's increased impermeable surface. There's fill that goes in. It kind of narrows the channel and just decreases that. It results in concentrated stream power, greater cost from rescue, from damage to homes, infrastructure, businesses, things like that. And really, Eileen mentioned that I had gone to some training just recently, and really, as a certified floodplain manager, I have to do continuing education credits, and typically I go down to Emmitsburg, Maryland. FEMA actually has a program where they pay for local municipalities to go down and do that. This recent one, I got a scholarship to go to the Northwest Regional Floodplain Managers Association in Bellingham, Washington. And I sort of had an epiphany. and I realized that, so a lot of these they're very sophisticated and they have entire branches of their government dedicated to floodplain management, and they have very expensive studies and these multi-agency stakeholder meetings and very strict regulations. A lot of them are buying back flood zone that's been developed. A lot of times they'll say, okay, you can build in the flood zone, but you have to tear down this building or this parking lot in order to build here. And what I realize is that we're very lucky in the fact that our flood zones are mostly undeveloped at this point. And I think that we can get a glimpse of the future by looking down south and seeing these places that have developed around rivers and see what they're going through because of the way that they developed prior. And it seems to me that if we just continue to allow all this development and subdivision and things like that into flood zones as we are now, then ultimately we will end up like the municipalities that are down south, and you end up buying it back for a lot more. So I want to finish with a quote here. And this is from 1891. I dove deep on this one. Right? As population has increased, men have not only failed to devise means for suppressing or for escaping this evil, being floods, but have a singular short-sightedness rushed into its chosen paths. I just hope that we have the borough leadership here. I hope that we have the vision and the courage and leadership to really be smart and prudent about going forward and making sure we don't make the same mistakes that our predecessors did, or the people down south. So, with that, I would like to make one note. I did an incorrect email on that last slide. So it's actually alex.strawn@matsugov.us. So.
Not hot nail, huh? Questions? Assemblymember Sykes.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through the mayor to Mr. Strawn. Could you just elaborate for a point on what you just talked about buying people out of floodways? So let's say you've got maybe one or two structures in an existing floodway and that it later gets developed. Why are people being bought out of those floodways at a later time? I mean, right now we do have a buyback program, and it is because the federal government recognized that it's cheaper to buy people out than it is to keep paying insurance when they rebuild. So they got that. They got that right. But I just would like a little clarification of why we should be buying back if we already know and can warn people that they're in a floodway.
Yeah, so what I've seen that has happened in other municipalities is as a flood zone gets developed, it decreases the flood carrying capacity, and it ultimately ends up in more extreme, more damaging floods and more frequent floods. And not only development in the flood zone, but also development out of the flood zone where you have more impermeable surface. It causes more water to go into the flood zone. You know what, these are infrequent enough that we get complacent and just keep building and building and building, and then something really bad happens, and then they say, oh gosh, we really messed that up, let's buy this back and let's make room for that area, you know, or this levee that we had here is causing damage into a different place, and so we need to move that back. In order to do that, they have to buy property. It is really the trend that is happening down south, is really buying back that land in order to make it a public asset instead of a public liability. But as far as the buyouts that we have going on, that is erosion, and erosion is extremely difficult to model. You just can't model it. You can study the geomorphology of a riverbed, you know, the banks and things like that, but there's no way you can accurately model when the river is going to actually eat that away. So we're very behind the ball on that one, as far as just buying these up instead of doing something proactive about it. It's a tough one.
Anybody else? Ms. Patterson?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you. Well, that's really loud. Thank you for the presentation. I think it was very thorough, and I really enjoyed it. When you talked about people that are getting out of the floodplains and they're not going to have that insurance anymore, were those premium payments the burden of the homeowner, or did the borough also have some? Okay.
No, it's the insurance, the borough doesn't really get involved in that. We're just the regulatory piece of it. And one thing I didn't really mention is that once we had studies of different floodplains, we could determine the risk of different areas. The private industry is alive and well in insuring on flood also, not just the National Flood Insurance Program. But yeah, the borough doesn't get involved in that other than the education part of it. We have some knowledge and stuff like that. And the regulatory part, yeah.
Yes, Commissioner?
Thank you, Mayor. Through the Mayor to Mr. Strawn, by creating a subsidy for flood insurance, aren't we perpetuating the problem?
So when the National Flood Insurance Program was initially adopted, the goal was that these studies with associated regulations would ultimately dramatically reduce the amount of structures that are damaged in floods. In theory, that's how it work. And that's why they have this rule for substantially damaged, substantially improved. The rule is that if a house is destroyed by over 50% of its value, then it has to be built back into the regulations. But one of the main criticisms of the entire program is that there are some structures that are have flooded like 14 times and been rebuilt on the government dime, and that's a major criticism of it. And unfortunately, the rules are really set up for the insurance company and not for the benefit or safety of the public and things like that.
Commissioner Elder, did you want to jump in?
Commissioner Glashan, Mr. Mayor.
Oh, Glashan. I got it. Somebody said.
Okay. He usually sits by me, but not tonight. Mr. Strawn, I just wanted to make a statement and then disagree with you slightly. So with these high bedload rivers like the Matanuska, like the Susitna, from a flood protection standpoint, they're very much like an alluvial fan because the bedload's so high, the river course is always changing. And we don't need to look to the lower 48 to see how tough that is. We can just look at Seward and all the money they've spent on diversions and all the problems they have with their city and their developments on alluvial fans and the flooding they had this year with, you know, what was substantial rain, but nothing incredible.
Still south, kind of, right?
Anyone else? Well, thank you. How did you manage to get Steve Culligan in the same room with Mark Bagish in that photo?
I remember
That was a good one.
Yeah. 2 minutes late, there's already a seat left.
All right, well, thank you. Just a wonderful report. I enjoyed all the updates all the way back to 1850, whatever it was.
60.
Okay. Does that do it for our, I think that does it for our agenda. Anything else on the agenda? If not, we're going to switch over to comments. And Madam Chair, why don't you take over with your commissioners?
Sure. Commissioner Patterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to staff and everyone for being here today.
And just for the record, Assemblymember Leonard came at 6:40 p.m. Noticeably, welcome. I won't say noticeably late.
Commissioner Elder?
It's a pleasure being here this evening.
Commissioner Glashan?
Once again, thanks to the staff. They do a lot, stretched in a lot of different directions, and it's really incredible seeing the level of expertise we have in a borough like ours.
Commissioner Masonin?
I'd like to thank the staff for all the information and the reports, super helpful, and also congratulate the new assembly folks who just got seated, so congratulations.
And closing comments, I'm very interested in the community council, just because as a planning commission, we use their comprehensive plans extensively when we make our decisions. So I'm going to be really interested to see how that progresses. On a personal note, I'm one of those houses that came out of the flood zone plan, and it reduced my house payment by nearly $700 a month. So it's significant, and thank you very much for buying that. I probably paid for it myself. It's always a pleasure to be here and hear all the updates and see what's going on, and an opportunity to kind of jointly get some opinions. And so thank you very much for the invite.
Okay, I'll start with our staff. Mr. Moosey, yeah. Anything you want to add? Comments?
Good evening,
5-4.
5-4? You said it, not me.
So the Dodgers are moving up, great, okay. Mr. Spropolis, anything else? Madam Clerk? Assemblymember Sykes?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thanks to the assembly members and to all the members of the Planning Commission. I really always learn something when we have these meetings. I did want to mention a couple of other things that weren't discussed tonight but are in your packets. In your orange folder, there is a memorandum of understanding that's going to be coming forward on air quality. And it's been worked on for some time, but the upshot of it is that it's a proposal to create a Butte air quality district, and people were concerned about, you may hear about people complaining that we're going to steal our wood stoves or it's going to regulate their heating if they burn wood. Neither of those things has ever been true, and it won't be true now, but at least the regulations that are coming forward deals with that, and we do work with DEC in hopefully a proactive way so that we do not end up in a situation called non-attainment, which they can force you to do stuff and spend a lot of taxpayer monies that are not very useful. So if we can avoid that, that'd be good. So that will be coming before both the Planning Commission and the Assembly. I also just passed out, it's just 3 pages of a 79-page study, but it's from the 2012 Wetlands Management Plan, and there's really some great stuff in here. And we're dealing with wetlands on a number of issues. The Fish and Wildlife Commission at our borough and is dealing with trying to preserve our salmon runs, or restore them really, because we have 8 out of the 14 streams of concern in the entire state. And so over the past 3 years, there's been a change in the fact that the Corps of Engineers was very carefully going through anything that anybody said was might be a wetland. In fact, they even came up to my elevation on Lazy Mountain, and they said, these are aquatic plants, and even though there's no water here, we have the authority to regulate this because this flows into the waters of the United States. That was in like 2012 or something. But in 2014, they started giving a pass to anybody that wanted to do anything. And recently, we just witnessed the fact that 74 miles of road to Don and Mine, which we do support, didn't require any mitigation. And these are the same lands and where that affect the salmon that we're trying to restore. And so, you know, I think we have to have both development and be able to protect our natural resources. And so this is, the state has even suggested getting involved in regulating the wetlands because the federal government hasn't been doing a lot the past 3 years. So this is coming before us. I think we need to be part of this process, and I just would remind and for the new assembly members, we did request a meeting with the Corps, and I think we need to talk to the other agencies that are involved who are also concerned with these very same issues. So I just wanted to put this is the summary that's here, just the 4 pages of summary. If you read that, you'll get a pretty good flavor for what the other 79 pages is, and if you just type in the title, it'll come up first on your Google search. And with that, I mean, doing an update of the comprehensive plan, the overall comprehensive plan, it's never really that fun, but you know, it gives you a chance to look back at where you were and so many things that have changed. The changes have just been incredible, and they've been fast. And I think we should pay attention to it, and you know, if the time is right to do that, I think that we should suck it up and do it. And I wish you all a real good evening, and thanks again for coming, and thanks for the comments and the reports.
Okay, thank you. Assemblymember McKee.
Jim talked enough for both of us.
Thank you for your brevity. See, Assemblymember Bovee.
I'd like to thank everyone for the warm welcome, and I appreciate your patience going forward as I start to figure out how this all fits together.
Thank you, Senator Mayfield.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to thank the commissioners as well as staff and congratulate the staff on giving us such great briefings. I am a little concerned with the flood management plan. I kind of thought that project had progressed more, but I imagine these things take some time. But having some concerns there, I am interested in following up with Mr. Strawn in regards to that. And having been a certified flood adjuster in my professional career, I'm also interested in some of the ways that we can encourage development in non-flood impacted areas. So look forward to following up with you on that, Alex. Thanks. Have a great evening, everybody.
Thank you, Senator Sumner.
I'd like to thank the commissioners and staff for the informative presentation, and thank you guys for welcoming to the assembly.
Senator Leonard?
No comment, Mayor.
Deputy Mayor Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm very humbled to be a small part of the great work that's being done by this borough, especially its great staff. I'm just really impressed with your work, and I'm thankful for that. And I also, real fast, since she wasn't able to be here last week, I just recognized Assemblymember Doty in the audience and wanted to just express my deep gratitude for the opportunity to work with you over the last 3 years, and I feel like I was able to learn a lot from someone who is got a lot more knowledge than I do, and I appreciate the opportunity to work side by side with you and to collaborate on some of the things we were able to do together. So thanks for your service. I look forward to continuing to working with you in the future. I'm really glad to see you here tonight. Thank you.
Yes, I totally agree with that. Mr. Beck, it was nice to see you here tonight, Ms. Doty, and it was a pleasure working with you on the assembly, and we're going to miss you, as I think I've stated, even in Mr. Anderson's Frontiersman. And so nice to see you here tonight. And to the commissioners, I apologize to Mr. Elder and Mr. Glashen for getting you mixed up, but I had a note that had an arrow pointed that way, Elder. So, but anyway, I apologize. And it's always a pleasure to be here with the Planning Commission, and we get a chance to look over some issues that we're mutual, and we appreciate everything you do for the borough and looking into issues. And I hope you take this Title 28-6 very seriously. I think it's got some things that we could probably change or update or revise so that the borough could continue to grow, and we could have a timber harvest and timber sales. I know this one we had up in Chijuk as the word mess is kind of a accurate word with the tariffs and the status of it right now. So, but maybe we could rewrite that title so that there's different levels of logging available to different sized operations, I guess is what I'd like to see, and make sure it doesn't eliminate others or and it, you know, it kind of looks like logging is kind of local. We haven't been able to generate a massive logging program that's leaving the borough, so I hope we could work on that. So with that, any updates on the ball game? I'm getting really worried. Still the same, huh? It's okay. So what's that? Keep being worried. Okay. So.
May I ask for a second audience participation?
A second audience participation? Any objection? None? Go ahead, please.
Mr. Mayor, I don't have a timer up.
I got one.
I apologize. Let's
make this short.
My name is Tom Robertson. I'm still back here trying to make
it. Well, thank you. I'm sorry. Anyways. Since I've retired from the National Guard, I went around the state and did emergency management as well as civil defense. For those of the borough assembly people don't know me. And I'm still trying to get the funding to do what I call emergency fill station, which means it's a drain that goes to the deep end of the pool and it comes out to the curb and looks like a regular old fire hydrant. That's what it looks like. But this fire hydrant is tied to the city water main. What I'm proposing to do, the new fill station only goes to the deep end. It's not tied to the water main at all. So water can be drafted out in emergency for emergency fire water, or water can be brought in from outside areas and pumped into the pool after it's been drained. It can be pumped in and used for emergency fill station. I'm talking about when you have a major earthquake, a lot of these water towers and water mains we have are gonna fail. And so this is the state of the art. The whole state of Alaska is going to this kind of concept where you have an emergency fill station. I started working on this in Nikiski Fire Department in 1974. We redid the pools in 94. And all over the state of Alaska is doing this, and all over the country. Quick example, give you an idea. In 1983, I came with the Nikiski Fire Department. We laid 1,000 feet of hose at the airport, and we showed the fire departments how to come up with this 5-inch hose, a big yellow hose, to cut down friction loss. And that way we didn't need to do what we call relay pumping. One fire truck could pump 1,000 gallons a minute, 1,000 feet away, and it only took one fire truck. So we had less fire trucks, less people, and that way it saves time, saves money, and ultimately saves lives. This is the same concept I'm proposing with the borough, to go to these new pools. And when these pools are being built, like Wessel is being built today, I took pictures. They got a big forms where they get ready to pour concrete. And I want to put this drain underneath there before they pour the concrete. And this will come out to the city, to the curb, where one fire truck and one fireman can draw water and go. Saves time, saves money, saves lives, saves fire trucks, saves water, and again, it will hopefully save lives. And I didn't have one for the new people. Or last week I didn't get them. Anybody else? I'll be glad to give them to you. Anybody got any quick questions?
I think we're okay. We understand the concept. Appreciate it.
Okay, I do have this for the people who don't have one.
Well, you give that to clerk, I think. You know, we received those handouts at one of the assembly meetings. And while we're waiting, I want to thank borough staff for always coming, and Ms. Probasco and all the planning commissioners and everybody else. Thank you for always presenting to us, and we really do appreciate it. With that, we'll adjourn at 7:29 p.m.